If you could, just give me a brief bio of yourself.
Okay. Well, I am a full-time writer and lecturer specializing in issues of race and racial discrimination. So for the last 6 years, I've been on the road essentially probably speaking 7 months out of the year, 50, 60 engagements a year, doing anti-racism trainings, seminars, workshops, lectures at colleges, government agencies, nonprofit groups, high schools, community groups, that kind of thing, trade unions. And my background, you know, for the past, really for the past, gosh, I guess 11 years now, has been doing anti-racism work full-time. For the first few years, that was within various nonprofit organizations. I started out doing work against David Duke in Louisiana for a couple of years when I got out of college in 1990. And from that, because it was fairly high profile, I was, you know, fortunate enough to get picked up by a lecture bureau, speakers bureau, lecture agency, and have been on the road ever since. So I do those, you know, like I said, about 7 months out of the year. I write two or three articles a month for various distribution, you know, sources, ZNet and Alternet in particular, working on a couple of books, and I'm affiliated as an advisor with the Race Relations Institute at Fisk University, which is a historically black college here in Nashville.
One of the outlets you write for is Alternet, alternet.org,
right.
And your most recent article is entitled The White Denial Firestorm.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could tell us why you wrote that latest article, what that was based on.
Well, I wrote that piece, actually, I was asked to by the folks at Alternet. Normally, I just submit, you know, one or two pieces a month for their syndication service. But in this particular case, they asked me to write a piece because the previous article I had done for them, which had been on the issue of the school shootings, the latest one in Santee, California, and the white denial that I was seeing surrounding that school shooting and other school shootings whereby whites, you know, no matter how many times this happens, seem to say the same thing. They always say, well, this wasn't supposed to happen here. You know, how could this happen? In other words, our stereotypes of crime and violence are so typically of black folks, Latino folks, poor folks of whatever color, that when we see violence or dysfunction or deviant behavior in white middle-class suburbs, we just don't know how to deal with it because we're so bought into those stereotypes. So I'd written that piece back in March, and it created a huge firestorm of controversy. I received about 8,000 emails. I'm still getting emails on this piece, actually. I've received about 8,000 in the last 3 months. It was written up in the L.A. Times, the Washington Post. It was printed, the actual article was printed in papers all around the country, and then stories about the article or about the column were written in all these other newspapers. And it became the most heavily trafficked article that Alternet had ever had on their service. They got, I think they've gotten over 100,000 hits, just people reading that particular article. So because of all this, they had wanted me to write a piece addressing the firestorm of interest and controversy. I mean, I was getting emails from people saying, you know, I'm teaching this in my class. I was getting stuff from, you know, preachers and ministers saying, I'm going to use this as my Sunday sermon. I was getting things from family members saying, you know, my whole family talked about this article around the dinner table. I was getting emails from 14 and 15-year-old black kids who were thanking me for taking the stigma off of them for once, you know, sort of making the point that I made in the first original article that, you know, deviance and dysfunction and violence don't have a race or don't have a color, and that's something that a lot of these kids, you know, they know what racial profiling is about because they bear the brunt of it every day, every week, every month. And so for someone to write an article saying, you know, it's not just black kids who do things, you know, that our stereotypes are false, was really liberating for them, apparently. It was particularly important, I think, for black folks to hear a white person say it, so I was happy to have been able to do that. So Alternet wanted me to write this piece. I wrote it. The 2 points that I wanted to make most in that article, the follow-up, was number one, how interesting I thought it was and distressing I thought it was that, you know, here was an article where I was basically just saying our stereotypes of race and violence and crime are wrong, but whites tend to buy into them. Well, this is stuff that black folks say all the time. You know, people of color know this. And yet, when they say the same kind of thing or when they point out that every one of these school shooters has been white, and yet we still, you know, hear the FBI saying there is no profile of a school shooter, which is their official position, black folks know how absurd that is because they know how quickly they get profiled. But yet when a white man stands up and says the same thing as I did in that first piece in March, you know, it creates all of a sudden people, oh, yeah, you know, white folks all of a sudden listen and say, I never thought of that. And so I was trying to point out in the follow-up that, in fact, the reaction to it had been an example of white privilege. It had been an example of white denial. You know, white folks just never heard this message when people of color said it, but all of a sudden one of their own says it and they want to listen. So I thought that was interesting. And then the second thing was just to point out the kinds of reactions. And I think what the reactions to that article indicated advocated was that there are, you know, thousands of people, millions of people in this country who are hungry to have real and meaningful dialogue and discussion about issues of race, about media portrayal of crime and race and media bias regarding racial issues, because all of those were addressed in the article, and it just don't have a lot of outlets for it. So I thought it was good, you know, that here was a hard-hitting piece that apparently opened up some discussion, and that's obviously a positive thing that I hope to continue doing.
I understand one of the people that was moved by your original article was one of the members of the Columbine SWAT team. Is that correct?
Yeah, this guy emailed me probably about 2 weeks after the article ran. And, you know, when he started off telling me that he was a member of the Columbine SWAT team, I immediately, because of my own preconceived notions of what a SWAT team member would probably be like, particularly one in Littleton, I probably jumped to conclusions. Not probably, I did, and I assumed, oh God, you know, he's going to ring me over, you know, he's going to put me through the ringer and criticize me for making this argument. But in fact, what he said was that I was more correct in my analysis than even I knew, because when they had gotten to Columbine after that shooting in 99, you know, the SWAT guys, the actual guys with the flak jackets who would have had to go in, they said they were ready to go, you know, and had, you know, had this been inner city Denver, you know, they would have gone in. There'd have been no hesitation. But that their commanding officers kept telling them to hold off and to pull back, because there was this, you know, sort of paralysis that set in, because the commanding officers kept saying, in effect, you know, these are rich kids, they're white kids, they had drive nice cars, it's a nice neighborhood. If we go in here and something goes wrong, you know, and we get blamed, we're going to get sued. And so the irony of this was that here you had this community that is both racially privileged, as almost all white people, and economically privileged, as very much upper middle class. And in this particular case, neither their color nor their economic status protected them from danger. In fact, in a weird sort of ironic twist, their status and their racial privilege and their class privilege might have actually hurt them, because it paralyzed the SWAT team. The commanding officer simply didn't know how to respond to violence and dysfunction when it didn't have a black or brown face. On the other hand, had this been downtown, you know, inner city Denver, where the kids would have been overwhelmingly black or Latino, they would have gone in, and if somebody died, they died, you know. So it just sort of shows, ironically, how racial privilege and class privilege in the long run can be dysfunctional and debilitating, even for those who are the recipients of that privilege. I think that's a perfect example of it.
And that brings us to an article that was forwarded to me through ZNet that you'd written recently, entitled Breaking the Cycle of White Dependency.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could talk about that. You started out with talking about the concept of projection.
Yeah. Well, you know, I for a long time I've been thinking about this, but then recently, as the debate over reparations for slavery and segregation have become a hot topic nationwide, and as I really haven't written about that article specifically, I'm about to actually for a book, but because people know my views on issues like that, I get a lot of emails from people, and it's people usually yelling at me saying, you know, black people are just looking for a handout, you know, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's welfare, whether it's reparations. And, you know, I always get these emails from folks saying how dependent black people are either on government or really more specifically on whites. And for a long time, I had been thinking about the ways in which, you know, if anything, people who are white or called white in this society, if anything, we're the ones who have been most dependent on government, to be sure, and also on black people. I mean, whites historically, and not just black people, but people of color generally, whites historically, from the very time of colonization and conquest and enslavement, have depended on the labor of black and brown people, on the land of black, brown, and red people, on the labor of Chinese coming to build the railroads, Mexicans teaching us how to get gold out of riverbeds and quartz, blacks to do the work in the South that was critical to the growth of the antebellum economy, blacks who ultimately had to join the Civil War effort for the Union in order for the Union to win. It was that infusion of, you know, 200,000 or so black military in the Union forces that helped the Union win the Civil War. And really, you can trace it all the way from the time of slavery and conquest even to now, where every year black consumers spend about $500 billion annually with white-owned businesses. And those white-owned businesses primarily employ white people. Their stockholders, if they're public, are primarily white people. Their owners live in white communities. So, in effect, black folks are transferring $500 billion a year, half a trillion dollars annually, to white folks, which is far more than all the so-called welfare programs, all the benefits of affirmative action, all that put together would come nowhere near $500 billion. So if anything, if anyone is dependent, really white America and white businesses and white companies and white individuals are more dependent on, always have been, on black and brown people than they have been on us. And I thought that was something that was important to point out, both for historical accuracy and also to simply put this issue of whether it's reparations or affirmative action in perspective. Whites have received affirmative action, if you will, since the beginning of this country, since before this country was a country, whether it was, you know, free land giveaways under the Homestead Act or GI Bill benefits that were given out in a racially restrictive manner, or Federal Housing Administration loans, VA loans. All of these things that really were whites only, for the most part, that we never thought about as being racial handouts, but in effect, if whites were eligible for these things and people of color weren't, the effect of that is that whites were given a handout, if you will, that they were dependent, and yet we just never think of ourselves that way.
And you also point out in the article the dependence that we have on people of color as being spokespeople for our
views. Yeah, this is something I've actually gotten a lot of flack for, but I stand by it. My argument was, you know, it's interesting. If you look around today, you see an increasing number, it seems, and certainly an increasing prominence of people of color who are sort of out front as conservative spokespersons against affirmative action, for example. So you see people like Larry Elder, you know, whose background as a social scientist is non-existent. The guy is the host of Moral Court on television, for God's sake. He has no background in these issues. But he writes a book like, you know, 10 Things You Can't Say in America, or whatever it's called. He's a black, ultra-conservative, libertarian type, and he basically, you know, opposes affirmative action, opposes any kind of government program for poor people, essentially. And this guy becomes a prominent spokesperson, saying things that, frankly, were he white saying those things, would probably get him in a lot of trouble because folks would sort of realize it was racist. So what I think is interesting is how people like Larry Elder, Ken Hamblin, Clarence Thomas, Shelby Steele, John McWhorter, some of the people who have, and Linda Chavez, you know, among Latinas as well, people of color sort of being put out there. And when I say put out there, I'm not trying to take away from their abilities as writers. Perhaps some of them are fairly flashy. Dinesh D'Souza is a decent writer, for example. But here he is, a person of color, saying these things and all these other names I mentioned in ways that white folks really couldn't get away with. If you look at the way, David Duke is looked at, for example, when he says some of the things he says about black intelligence or black culture, people sort of know that it's overtly racist. But you can get a Dinesh D'Souza to say a lot of the very same stuff, and because he's a person of color, it somehow is looked at as being more legitimate because, oh, well, he can't be a racist. He's a person of color himself, which is, of course, silly, because people of color can certainly be racist against their own or other people of color, and are oftentimes. So the point I was trying to make was that it's convenient, to say the least, that these black and brown conservatives and reactionaries are coming to the forefront, because every time I get into an argument with somebody about these kinds of issues, they invariably bring up the fact that Ken Hamblin, Larry Elder, Walter Williams, you know, they throw out the same names. Hey, these people say it, so my argument can't be racist because here's a black person who agrees with me. The irony of that being, you know, when was the last time these people ever cared about what a black person said? But suddenly they find one that agrees with them, and that somehow takes the racial stigma off of the argument. So I think that's a form of dependence. I think we've become dependent on having those kind of people who we can put out there and say, see, you know, our views aren't racist. And that is a dependence, whereas if we had to make those arguments alone, we'd probably have a heck of a lot harder time making them.
I know that was a tactic that was used in Washington State for Initiative 200 as well.
Right.
There was...
Well, I mean, you know, Ward Connerly is really a perfect example of this phenomenon, and I can't remember if his name was in the article or not, but I certainly talk a lot about him as I go around the country. I mean, Ward Connerly is a guy who, you know, stories have been written about this in many different outlets, who received the benefits of affirmative action. Now, he'll argue that he didn't ask for them, but that's sort of beside the point. As a minority contractor involved in housing rehabilitation contracts in the state of California, he received about half of the money that his business made in the years prior to the affirmative action vote in 1996, Proposition 209, about half of the money that he had made had come from contracts that, where frankly he had received some level of preference as a minority contractor. Now, I, for one, as a supporter of affirmative action, don't have any problem with that at all. I think it's great that Ward Connerly and his business were able to make money doing this kind of work, and frankly, had it not been for affirmative action, folks like Ward Connerly might have been locked out of the networks, and that would be unfair. But the horrible thing is, here you have Connerly, you know, who is put out there as the spokesman, trying to attack the very program And it was so blatantly obvious in California when Proposition 209 was first dreamt up, before it had a number, when it was just the California Civil Rights Initiative, so-called, the two spokespeople for it were Glenn Custard and Tom Wood, two white guys, two white academics. They were the spokespeople, and they were the ones who were out there. And within about 6 months, it was pretty obvious to those folks that it just wasn't going to work. If these two white guys were the public face of this proposition, that it was going to be seen as this sort of angry white guy backlash. And so what better to sort of prevent that criticism than by bringing in someone like Ward Connerly to make the argument? And so you never heard from Tom Wood again. You know, Tom Wood was exposed on Dateline, I believe it was, for having lied. He came up with his own story of personal victimization. He had been the victim of reverse discrimination because some black woman had gotten a faculty position that he was more qualified for. Well, Dateline, you know, looked into it and found out that, in fact, this woman was eminently more qualified than he was. She'd written two or three books. He hadn't written anything in 20 years. And once that happened, of course, you know, he could no longer be the public face of the proposition. So he just sort of faded into the background. Nobody heard from him. And Ward Connerly became the spokesperson. And then he, you know, was cut loose on Washington State as well and tried to start the same kind of thing in Florida, although that was sidetracked to some degree so far. So, I mean, I think it just goes to show how really dependent whites are on the cover, if you will, that black and brown conservatives can provide for us. When we want to say something but we don't want to seem racist, we just get a brown face to say it, and then we somehow feel better.
A lot of these ideas are being continued to be perpetuated by the media, the major media.
Right.
Is that something that you're seeing around the country as being pretty consistent?
Which ideas? The idea of dependence?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there have been a number of books and scholarly articles about the way that poor people are portrayed, for example, the way that welfare recipients are portrayed. Really good book, Martin Gillen's book, Why Americans Hate Welfare, was an excellent book because it talks about the ways in which, in the last 20 years, the media, particularly mainstream broadcast media and even print media to a degree, have consistently overrepresented blacks and Latinos in stories about the poor, in stories about welfare recipients. If you go back to the 1960s, from about the mid-60s to the early 70s, it was whites who were mostly portrayed as poor folks, and it was whites who were mostly portrayed as recipients of various government aid programs, and interestingly enough, the support level for those programs was much higher. And then, as the face of the welfare recipient changed, particularly in the public media, not so much in reality, the face didn't really change numerically. Whites were still, you know, more of the welfare recipients, but the public image that was put out by the media changed, and all of a sudden you began to see a lot of black faces, and then you saw the support levels drop. And Gillens does a very good job of pointing out that when you control for a whole number of factors that affect public perception of things like welfare, that really one of the primary determiners for whether or not someone is going to be supportive of government income support or so-called welfare programs is the degree to which they perceive those programs as benefiting mostly minorities. And if they perceive those programs as being mostly about helping black and brown people, they are far less likely to support those things than they would be if they believe those programs to be mostly about white people. And he shows this very consistently in this book. So I think that's one example of how the notion of black dependence or minority dependence has been perpetuated over the years. And certainly, I'm afraid that with the reparations debate sort of coming to the forefront now, that the media will probably, as is usually the case, not do a particularly good job explaining what that is about. And you know, a recent story on reparations that 2020 did was sort of a perfect example of this. You know, they spent a very small amount of time actually discussing the arguments that the primary movers and shakers in the reparations movement are making, people like Randall Robinson. And instead, you know, they focused a good 5 minutes of their show on this one elderly black guy who goes around the country essentially ripping black people off by saying, you know, if you pay me $50, I'll file your reparations claim for you and you'll get a check for $50,000 in the mail. And he goes around just like a lot of ministers and just like a lot of, you know, snake oil salesmen, essentially ripping off black people. And that's certainly a story, but to put that in the context of this reparations discussion is to, you know, number one, skew that discussion towards this side issue of this one individual black guy who happens to be a con man, it seems. And also, it gives the impression of, aha, see, here's a black guy who's preying on his own people, and these black folks are so dependent on the idea of getting a government check that they'll fork over their money to this guy. And it just sort of, it reinforces the handout mentality that a lot of white folks have vis-a-vis black people, the idea that that's all they're looking for. And I think that the media is going to have to really do a better job of covering these issues. And, of course, you know, the idea of white dependence on black people is just never discussed. I mean, these things about, you know, if you go back even historically, white dependence on slave labor is sort of intuitively understood, but I don't think we understand it. It's not taught very clearly in the history books just how important that slave labor was to the creation of the economy and the creation of white wealth. We certainly don't talk much in our history books in high schools about the dependence on Asian labor, particularly Chinese labor, to build the railroads. We certainly don't learn about the importance of Indian people teaching white folks, frankly, how to farm, because we didn't know how to do it. And if it hadn't been for them teaching us those skills, we would have starved to death in the colonies in the 1620s. You know, that's just not discussed because it detracts from the myth of American heroism, you know, American accomplishment, this idea that these brave, noble, God-fearing people came to this land and built something out of nothing, when in fact, you know, a lot of people who were frankly criminals got on a boat, came from Europe, didn't know how to do anything when they got here, were starving to death, took other people's land, forced other people to work for them, and had it not been for those people of color essentially bailing us out, we would have died. We would have died off, and the experiment known as America probably would never have happened at all.
Yeah, it seems like an excellent example of a clear rewriting of the history books.
Right. I mean, well, not even a rewriting. It's just that's been the writing. There hasn't been the correction made in the history books at all, because history has always been written by the victors, and in this case, the victors were, you know, white males with property, and naturally, they're not going to want to show the levels of interdependence. Naturally, really what I'm saying here is that all of us are dependent on each other. I don't mean to imply that whites are necessarily, you know, incapable of doing for ourselves. It just so happens that we never have. You know, I'm sure white folks can do for themselves. I'm sure that, you know, millions do every day in some sense, but historically speaking, we've never really had to do for ourselves. We've always had a certain head start. We've always had a certain heads up. We've always had a certain advantage thanks to things like institutional racism. And so the point I was really trying to get at was that there's this system of privilege, there's this system of advantage that really fosters white dependence on black people. I'm not saying it's something inherent. I certainly don't think white people are inherently incapable of self support or self-help, but it just so happens to be the case that so long as racism, and institutional racism in particular, is allowed to continue, we'll never really know just what white people are really capable of. You know, the irony is that we are, you know, because of this system, never really proving ourselves because we have these advantages. And I, for one, and I think a lot of other white folks, would like to just be able to prove our own abilities without this head start, you know, but we'll never find out as long as racism remains.
So what do you see as potential first steps and solutions in overcoming institutionalized racism?
Well, I mean, that's you know, we could spend 2 hours on that. I mean, I think that the first thing is we just have to tell the truth. And one of the reasons that I write the pieces that I write and send them out the way that I do is because I think there's been so little truth said, particularly by whites. People of color tell the truth about this stuff, but no one wants to listen. So I think it's incumbent upon whites of goodwill who understand these issues to step forward, to become strong allies, to be accountable to people of color, to be sure to take our lead from people of color, but nonetheless to become prominent in our own explication of the truth. And I think telling the truth has a certain potentially liberating effect. Obviously, telling it once won't do it. Telling it twice won't do it. But when you tell the truth enough and you spread that truth to others and you make sure that that truth is becoming inculcated in the way the schools teach about certain things, in the way politicians talk about certain things, hopefully in the way media frames certain things, then there's a real opportunity to affect consciousness. Obviously, beyond affecting consciousness, though, we have to talk about really altering institutions. And the only way that's going to happen, frankly, is for people of color in leadership positions and white folks as strong allies to people of color are going to have to challenge those institutions and figure out ways to, A, withdraw our support from institutions that perpetuate institutional racism, and then, B, create alternative institutions when those mainstream institutions don't serve us. So that means figuring out ways to attack racial profiling, figuring out ways to attack redlining by banks, and figuring out ways to attack media distortions of issues like crime and violence. And if protests and demonstrations and boycotts and things of that nature don't have the effect that's necessary on those mainstream institutions, then we have to start talking about creating alternative ones. Alternative media, obviously, would be very important. Alternative schools, frankly, would be very important. We have to really start thinking about creating institutions that will serve the purpose of eliminating oppression and racial hierarchy. And if the existing institutions won't change, we obviously need to continue to push them to, but at the same time create some of our own institutions that will do that work and thereby, you know, create an alternative example that can be put out there as a way that, you know, the workforce can be organized, as a way that a school can run, an alternative method of doing media. I mean, there are all kinds of examples that we could draw upon. We just, you know, really have to take it upon ourselves to do that, I think.
All right, you mentioned several times racial profiling, and
right,
that's a big issue here in Seattle right now. We've
sure.
got multiple task forces that were created to focus on that. And if one were just paying attention to getting their information from the media, we would assume that the only place really concerned with that right now was, let's say, Seattle and Cincinnati. But since you travel the country and deal with these issues all the time, can you address if that's a little more widespread?
I mean, you know, it is probably the number one concern or number two or three concern of just about every person of color that I meet around the country. And that doesn't matter whether they're poor, whether they're middle class, whether they're working class, or whether they're quite affluent. In fact, to some degree, the more affluent a person of color is, the more important the racial profiling issue becomes, because it's oftentimes more affluent Black and Latino folks who are driving nice cars, for example, or dressed very nicely, who have a little bit of money, who are the most suspected. Poor people of color are obviously suspected anywhere they go, and so it's really hard to tell what level of profiling among the poor is racial and what level is economic or what level is a combination. But among the more affluent or the middle class, it's pretty obvious. You know, if you're a middle class professional, Black or Latino or Asian male, for example, and you're stopped disproportionately and never ticketed, you know, just stopped and asked questions by a patrolman and then let go, and this happens to you over and over and over again, there's something going on. And I hear those stories everywhere I go. I hear them certainly in the Pacific Northwest. I hear them in the South. I hear them in the Midwest. I hear them in the Northeast. There's nowhere that I travel where I don't hear about it. And when I write articles about it, I get emails, obviously, and letters and phone calls, frankly, from people all around the country who are talking about their own experiences, many of them dealing with police, many of them dealing with store clerks, you know, many of them dealing with teachers and principals in schools who are clearly disproportionately sort of holding them out for punishment and or searches or suspicion. It goes on at every level of our institutional life, and yet there's a significant number of people who still refuse, particularly in the white community, who refuse to believe that profiling happens, or who try and justify it by saying, well, you know, the Black crime rate really is higher, so therefore, you know, this is an okay practice. But the reality is, you know, racial profiling is almost always done with regard to drug offenses. I mean, that is why police departments develop profiles. They don't really stop, you know, people randomly hoping that they're going to find the person that knocked over the liquor store the night before. They have other ways of catching armed robbers. They typically are looking for drugs. That's what most of these stop and frisk and search things in New York City or most other places are about. And the reality is that 76% of all drug users in this country are white people, and that whites at every age level are equally or even more likely to use illegal drugs than blacks are. Particularly among young kids, like high school kids, high school seniors, for example, white seniors far more likely to use every category of drug than black seniors. So if profiling and stop and search and frisks and car searches and things like that are primarily about drugs, and if whites are the ones who are doing most of the drugs and are actually more likely to do them, then not only is the racial profiling against black and Latino kids and adults racist, it's also dumb policy. And the point that I think needs to be made is that this kind of thing doesn't have anything to do with crime fighting. It doesn't reduce the amount of drug use. It doesn't reduce the amount of drug trafficking. The Customs Bureau, for example, 2 years ago was caught having racially profiled black women, particularly coming through customs checkpoints at international airports. And they found that black women were 9 times more likely than white women to be stopped and searched for drugs, but that white women were actually twice as likely to actually have drugs on them. Now, you know, this really raises two questions. I mean, number one, the racism of it, obviously, but then number two is just the stupidity of it. If white women are twice as likely to be found with drugs on them when you actually stop them, but you stop black women 9 times more often, then by definition, you're letting thousands of white women who you know good and well, based on your previous encounters, are going to have drugs on them, just sort of walk right through, and you're not stopping and searching them. So it's clearly racist. It's not good policy. It has nothing to do with crime control. It has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has everything to do with stereotypes, with preconceived notions, and frankly, with racism.
All right, Tim, how do people connect to your writings and your speeches?
Well, there are a number of ways to do that. I hope to have my own website up fairly soon. That'll make it much easier. But in the meantime, the two primary sources for which I write are ZNet, which is a subscription service for progressive and radical commentaries that's available by subscription, you know, but $10 a month, I think, is the standard amount, although it's a sliding scale. And people can subscribe to that at www.zmag.org. And it's a great service. I mean, it's not just my writing, but every day subscribers get a commentary in their email browser from one or another left or radical commentator. Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, myself, Barbara Ehrenreich, Manning Marable, a lot of people, big-name people, and also grassroots folks that you might not know about but who do some wonderful work. And it's sort of like having a progressive op-ed service, you know, every day. You're certainly not going to get radical commentary in your local newspaper most of the time, so this is a great alternative to that. And then secondly is I also write for Alternet, which is a syndication service for progressive commentary. And people can also, I think, sign up to receive sort of updates in their email, but at the very least can check out their website at www.alternet.org, and it's a great, you know, alternative site of information from people all around the country writing about a whole lot of different issues. So again, not just me, but a whole lot of really, really good folks out there.